Well, I can't promise you an emotional high on finances. In fact, it may be a little low if you get thinking about your own too much. But one thing I said about myself when he asked me, well, tell me a few things about yourself, and he didn't tell you what the last thing was I said. I'm having trouble with my budget. I really am. But aren't we all? It's a tough battle, and I'm not going to stand here and make you think I'm having an easy time. I'm not. We aren't. We've been married 25 years and this year, and it's never been easy. It's always been a challenge. So that's what we'll spend a little time talking about this morning. I wanted to mention, lest I forget, I just came out with a new publication called Memo to My Wife, and I put some over here if you'd like to have one. I tell you what it's designed to do for you married couples, in particular for your singles. I think it's useful for anybody. Dropped it by and gave it to a widow the other day because it's a documentation of information that people need to know if you suddenly go to be with the Lord. And in here is everything that a wife would need to know the day after her husband dies. The questions that need to be answered, where should I go, who should I see, what will my budget look like. It gives you kind of an opportunity to even think about some of these planning things that the possibility of death creates. And so I think it's important. The other thing I put over here was a little thing called Planning Your Will. It's really not a descriptive booklet. It's just a group of pages with questions that should be answered for your attorney. Before you go in, if you can save $50 an hour by putting the information together, it's helpful to do. And they appreciate it. I had an attorney work with me on this so that we get the right kind of information put together. And I've had a number of attorneys tell me when they received this book from their client, came to see them, handed them the book, he said, I had no more questions. So this is what we're after, is to try and answer, anticipate all the questions we possibly can. Of course, there's some questions you can't answer until you do talk to them and see what some of the laws of your state say. I'd like to take a little time to get acquainted, but I think we better not because of our time situation. So it's fun to get a little interaction. The people, speakers have probably done that all week with you. Where are you from? And there's one question I should ask, though. Is anybody from Greenville, Ohio? No navigators down in Greenville, are there? That's where my wife's from. I know she'd want me to ask that question if she were here this morning. Greenville is over by the Indiana border near Dayton, north of Dayton. I thought that you would be encouraged to know that you're not alone either in the matter of having, say, budget difficulties, and I'm sure a great many of you, maybe difficulty isn't the word, just challenge. But I clipped out of a magazine not so long ago one person's budget problems that I thought would encourage you. Her name is Jacqueline Onassis. Her 1976 income was $341,000. Now, the reason this article was written was because she did not see how she'd make ends meet. And I thought you'd be encouraged by some of the things that were in her budget that also are similar to your problem. Her income was $341,000. Her first problem was taxes, $100,000. So that left her only $241,000 to live on. And staff and servants are $85,000. That's just the people that kind of help you around the house. I heard, by the way, that Red Skelton figured out yesterday. Paul Harvey said Red Skelton decided to fire everybody that travels with him. He realized that he'd spent $17 million over the last few years just paying for the folks that travel along with him and get his hotel key and carry his bag up and so on. So he let them go. Then her clothes budget was $30,000. That's a little tough to live on, too. Food, $25,000, but there is a lot of entertainment. Entertainment, theater tickets, meals out, parties, $10,000, et cetera, et cetera. Ladies, I thought you'd appreciate her hairdressing and beauty care was $4,500 a year. And her gifts to relatives didn't amount to that much. Her contributions to charitable organizations were $2,000. So beauty care took a good more than twice as much as that. So, you see, there was a problem, and the problem was that she was $40,000 short, according to that budget. I don't know how she came out, but she's still eating, I think. This morning, I'd like to talk about, I hate to use the word budget. You know, as an accounting person, budgets bother me. Somebody came to me yesterday with their budget all laid out, and they were even using the words debits and credits, and those, you never use those words. We did, but I would never bring up that subject to you. A debit and a credit just is enough right there to put you on an emotional low. So you never talk about that, and we don't even try to talk about a budget. I like the word control. In fact, somebody said to me just recently that, isn't this whole thing a matter of discipline? And boy, that's it in a nutshell, isn't it? It's an attitude and a discipline. And I became a little undisciplined in the last few weeks, and it's troubling me. And I know you have, especially on vacation, huh? You think, boy, it's been a little too much. I think there are two questions that I'd like to answer this morning about control. One, why do we control anyway? Why is it necessary for us to control? Well, first of all, I think it's necessary because everything we have and we are belongs to the Lord. Well, I think that answers a lot of ills and problems and concerns that we have. Turn to one passage in 1 Chronicles. Borrowed my boss's Bible this morning, left mine at home inadvertently. It's what you do when you get into finances, you can't find your Bible. Don't believe that, it's not true. One thing I worried about this morning while you turned to 1 Chronicles, I worried about if I got an emotional high the night before and the day before, I wonder how I'd be for my quiet time. I'm going to have to ask Al about that. Get into those pinks and blues and whites, I might not be able to find my Bible the next morning. 1 Chronicles 29 and verse 11. Some of you probably memorized it, and I have too, but I always forget verses when I'm standing before groups. So I have to read it to you. But there's several expressions in here, I think, that are good and that relate to this thing that everything we have belongs to the Lord. In 1 Chronicles 29, David's just praising the Lord, beginning with verse 10. And then in verse 11, he says, "Thine, O Lord, is the greatness and the power and the glory and the victory and the majesty, for all that is in the heaven and in the earth is thine. All that's there is thine." And then the first expression in the next verse, "both riches and honor come of thee." Both rich. I dwelled on that. I was just reviewing that verse one day as I was driving around someplace in the Midwest a few months ago, and I was thinking about this expression, "both riches and honor come of thee." I think sometimes we feel a little uneasy if we suddenly become rich because of something creative we've done or some resource or some inheritance. We get uneasy about it. This verse has said, riches come of the Lord, or honor comes from the Lord. And we think, well, you know, I just shouldn't have any honor or any riches. The humble Christian thing to do is to dispel these kinds of things. And as I began to think about this, I thought, you know, riches and honor are not evil. I think the love of them would be, but to have them is not. And I think of the fact that we're bought with a price. We belong to Jesus Christ. We're bought with the blood of Jesus Christ. We belong to Him. All we have, all our resources belong to Him. And so I think this is an important factor in control, is the fact that we belong to Him. And isn't the basic verse in all of this really 1 Timothy 6:17, where you trust in the source of all riches, not in the riches themselves? This is what's important, to trust in the source of all the riches. We belong to the Lord. Let me just interject another quick thought here. I think sometimes that we get, and we're guilty of this in the church, and I'm very, very active in our church. I spent 2 hours yesterday with a business manager working on the budget and spent time the day before with the pastor on the finances. But I wonder sometimes if we don't get obsessed with what we're giving and our giving methods and the scriptural giving, all of which is important, but to the exclusion of the management of all the other resources God has given us. We're keenly concerned with whether we give 10% or 20% or whatever, but then sometimes we're completely haphazard about all the other resources God has given to us, and they all belong to Him, not just the 10 or 20. I know that one day an area rep called me from the East, and he said, there's a man in our area that has just made a large sum of money on a real estate situation, and he'd like to begin to learn how to give. And so when I was back there the next time, which wasn't too long after that, I stopped, had breakfast with him, and the first thing I discerned was he was in debt up to here, drowning. And I thought to myself, wait a minute, let's go back and learn how to control what you have. Let's start there. Sort of concurrently with the giving. And this was important. Secondly, I think that we need to control because it yields better results. Oh, I meant to tell you, by the way, that there were two books I wanted to recommend to you. One is George Bowman's book, Here's How to Succeed with Money, or Your Money, I can't remember. It's Moody Press, it's paperback, it sells for $1.25, it's been revised recently. Very good little book. And the other one is You Can Be Financially Free by George Fouché, who is has an MBA degree from Harvard and has a credit and collection agency down in Wichita, Kansas. And George and I spend a good deal of time together, and he's put together a good book by Fleming Ravel. I don't believe it's out in a soft cover, but a hard cover so far. Yes, You Can Be Financially Free by George Fouché. Good, every day. And the first one is Here's How to Succeed with Your Money, George Bowman, B-O-W-M-A-N. And Bowman in his book, and I change his formula just a little bit to make it simpler to explain, but he basically has a three-prong formula to finances, which I like, and that is that you give and you save and you spend. And he says everything falls in one of those three categories. First, you have a giving percentage, maybe 10 or maybe more, whatever. You save for long-range future purposes, and you operate on the balance. By the way, we do have, I think planning, there's so many things you could say about planning. Is planning a scriptural thing? Yes. I don't think the passage in Matthew, for instance, is an anti-planning verse where it says don't be anxious for your food or raiment. I think the emphasis is on don't have anxiety about it. But I don't think it's an anti-planning verse. For instance, I like Genesis 41 where Joseph plans during the 7 good years for the 7 lean years to come. Let me interject parenthetically an illustration that I think is helpful to that. I wasn't planning to do this, but sometimes I think we get a little nervous about planning. We think, well, I wonder if planning is really a scriptural thing to do. I just live from day to day and I don't have to worry about these things. Worry is right, but planning is different. I think here we'll represent the standard of living that you feel God wants you to have on this line here that I prefaced with a dollar sign. We need a larger platform in here, don't we? So that blackboard's up a little. And this line represents a person's standard of living that they feel God wants. Very subjective, isn't it? We all in here have very different standards of living. And here is a line that represents your income. And you go through what one person called the learning phase, where your income is below your standard of living, maybe military, college, and so on. You kind of think, well, things ought to be a little, you know, different. And then you get over here in an earning capacity. And all of a sudden you're out of college or you've got your additional degree or your professional or whatever, and suddenly your earnings go up. And what do? Standard of living goes right with it and eventually beyond it. And we're in trouble again. And then what happens is you get over here and somebody called this the yearning years. So Watts is 48, I'm 48, and I see, hey, you know, the navigators are going to kick me out to pasture one of these days. And as I think about planning and scriptural concepts of planning, I need to think about removing some of these high resources, quote unquote, over here, you see, for those years. And that's planning. We have probably 4 situations where we need to think about planning. We have death, disability, retirement, and emergencies. We live too long, we don't live long enough, and we eventually have retirement or we have an emergency situation. In 1 Timothy 5:8, the Lord talks about the person who doesn't take care of his loved ones is worse than an unbeliever. Now I have a responsibility to Patty, so that when we get over here and the Navs do say, you've had it, Watts, you're out the pasture, that I still am providing for her. So I still have, from the standpoint of retirement, a need to be thinking ahead and planning to move some of those resources over, you see, so that I'm providing for her at 65 as well as I am at 48. 65 or whatever. I don't know that... Frankly, I'm not sure retirement is scriptural. I haven't done a deep study in it, but I personally would rather never retire. I'd just like to change gears, but I don't want to retire. You know, change the kind of thing that I do. You'd be surprised how many people come to me who are over 65 will say and ask me the question that Al talked about here. How can we get involved with the navigators? Boy, I wish we had just a workforce like that in many Christian organizations. Wycliffe does, and we need to study it. So then we have disability and we have death, things to think about, which we don't have time to think about this morning, but I just mentioning those. Control yielding better results. Okay, I'm back here. I got off on something parenthetical here, and I promise we'll quit at 10:30, whatever I do in between. Anyway, I'm back to Bowman's illustration here of 10, 10, and 80. And I think one of the greatest blessings that I have is to get in people's homes and talk to people, all kinds of people, young people, older people, retired, and those just beginning, some just ready to get married and so on. And I was with a young couple up in Moscow, Idaho, and he's a junior high teacher. And they've just done one of the nicest jobs of managing their budget of anybody I've ever met. As I sat and talked with them, I discovered what their income was, their living situation, very modest, an apartment, no children. And as I recall, I think soon expecting, and she wasn't working. Very low income. And they'd take Bowman's idea, basically, and worked on a budget like we're going to talk about here in a little bit. And they worked it out, and they were disciplined to that budget and stuck to it. And yet there were many needs that were above what they had the provisions to provide for. And you know what they did? When they started out their year, they just started out with a prayer list. And they'd plan their budget the 1st of January or whatever and start listing the things that they felt they wanted to ask God for. And when I arrived, it was like January or February. They'd just completed the year before, so it gave me a good chance to get an overview of what had already happened in their lives. And here was a list of some 25 items. They didn't think of all 25, you know, right along the way in January, but further down the line, other things would come to mind that they wanted to trust the Lord for. Line drawn through every item. God had provided everything. And I somehow get the sense and the feeling that God had done that, you know, just because they had managed everything else so well. You know, I mean, He'd do it anyway, I suppose. But somehow I put those two together in my mind. And they were just planning their next year. And it was really fun to see what was happening in their lives. Well, I think control yields better results. I think the proper management of control, whatever we want to call it, cuts down on inefficient spending. For instance, I think one of the things that we have to be careful about, I know I do, is don't shop cost, but shop value. And sometimes you pay more to get something that lasts three times as long. I know you couples, you've talked about this, haven't you? One of you does it one way and one thinks the other. And somebody said in a book, I might have been Peter Drucker, he said, it's unwise to pay too much, but worse to pay too little. When you pay too much, you lose a little money, that's all. When you pay too little, you sometimes lose all, because the thing you bought was incapable of doing the thing it was bought to do. How many times I've done that, and opened the garbage can lid and dropped it in, you know, because it couldn't do the right thing for me because I bought a cheap product because I didn't want to pay too much. The common law of business balance prohibits paying little and getting a lot. It can't be done. If you deal with the lowest bidder, it's well to add something for the risk you run. If you do that, you'll have enough to pay for something better. You never know how far you can reach until you stretch. I've forgotten who wrote that, but I think it's important. And I think that's one thing, for instance, management brings in that's important. I think the kind of control that this couple had managed there in Idaho prevents the kind of credit interest charges of 18% that we get stuck with sometime if we're not careful, that sort of thing. You know, another thing that I think about here, it's really, isn't it an application of James 4:2? You ask not because you have not. I mean, you have not because you ask not. It's not that you want to consume it on your lust, but it's because there is a need, and we just haven't asked God for it. I'm sure Russ perhaps daintily touched on that subject. Rocked the windows and kept you awake. And so I think that's important. Thirdly, I think control keeps you out of debt. If we had time, and I better not take it, I'd ask you what debt really is. But I'm not. But, huh? Oh, okay, what is debt? She said ask you, so I'll do it. What is debt? Told you they were asleep. Yeah, that's a good definition. I wasn't thinking of, I didn't have a definition written down that was the answer to the question. I just was curious as to your expressions of how you felt about it.
Liability is greater than assets.
Okay, that's the accountant's answer, really. Liability is greater than assets, which means you're insolvent. It means you owe more than you have. If you were to wipe out and be buried tomorrow and so on, your debts would not be liquidated as a result of your assets. You had less assets than you did bills. What was the other one that somebody... Pardon?
Bondage.
Bondage. That's a result that I wanted to ask about, too. Okay, that's it. That's it. That's the Romans passage too. Owe no man anything. Really is when we have past due accounts that we can't pay. We could talk a lot about this, but bondage is the result. Pressure in the marriage is one of the three hardest things in a marriage. I could go on all morning telling you about live experiences, but some of you have experienced it or will experience it, and I know it's a tough area. And I'd, there are just so many things we could say about that. But it creates a terrible pressure. It creates an immobility. It immobilizes you for God's work or for anything, because pretty soon you're going to have to be a slave to the debt, like moonlighting, that sort of thing. And it just reduces your service. In fact, it creates a final problem, is where you're serving yourself, and that's exactly where Satan would like to have you. I think a last thing that I want to say about control is that control helps you to live within your means, which I think is the biggest problem we have in America today, is to live within our means. And there's so many things we could say here. The world tells us, if you want it, charge it. And I know I have a problem along that way, and I'm an impulsive person. And that's my reaction emotionally. I'd like to do that. I was going to show you a budget and ask you what was wrong with this budget, but I better not do that either. I want to get into some how-tos, and I'm worried about some of these illustrations getting it. I think a couple of things, though, I'd like to say about control still that I found helpful is that you repair, don't replace all the time. I've experienced that in our 25 years of being married, that my mechanical ability is zero. One thing that didn't say in my introduction was I was in the Navy for 4 years, and I remember those tests you took in the Navy of the Armed Forces. Well, my mechanical was zero. I mean, it wasn't zero, but, you know, it should have been. And so I really need help. And I think of James 4:2. I think of James 1 often. Now I say, now, Lord, you promised you'd give me wisdom. So I'm taking the dryer apart or the vacuum cleaner, and I don't know what I'm doing. And it just amazes me and thrills me to see the result. The thing will get back together and work. And I've really had fun with this, because it's an area in which I have total dependence on the Lord. And I could just tell you a lot of good stories about that, but I better not. So I think repair rather than replace. So see, America's replace-oriented. If the refrigerator smells, you go down to Sears and buy another one. I don't mean from the inside. I meant the Freon in the back was... No, I don't mean because it got dirty. It's like some people talk about ashtrays and your Cadillac fill up. You usually take it down and trade it in somebody. But I think maintenance. I'd love to show you my 1968 Chevrolet that we just had repainted. I think it's a gem. Maybe I'm going to have a sin problem with pride. But we recovered the seats, and my boss, Rod Sargent, taught me how to paint the carpet and restore the carpet in a car. And it was a beautiful little knack that he taught me, and it worked beautifully. And son, and then yesterday I replaced the windshield that has 131,000, 10 years of service, 131,000 miles, and showed it. It looked like I'd been through Rommel's desert battle with the thing, you know. But it does. It has 131,000 miles, and an engine's never been touched. But is that a reason to trade a car with 130,000 miles? Not really. And one of the keys, if you have a fairly new car, is to buy the finest oil. And some mechanics say, don't worry about the gas, but I do, because I've seen the effects of cheap gas in an engine. And I really believe, and I've just had my engine tested on that Chevy, and they say, no problems. 131,000, no problems. Now, it could, you know, something could go wrong mechanically with it, but I really think if you put a quality, you know, take care of things and have a quality maintenance program, I think this is important. After all, if you flew in here, you flew in on Frontier Airlines and those old Convair 580s. Now, you may have bounced a little, but those planes have put in many millions of miles, those propeller-driven Convair 580s that they fly around the Rocky Mountains. And believe me, they take a bouncing, don't they? Did somebody bounce? Did any of you bounce coming in here? Y'all drove? Well, if you haven't had that opportunity, fly out of here some afternoon. Okay, the next thing we want to talk about, the second thing, is how do we control? Enough watts on the fact that we need to control. We're all here and know that. Now tell us how to do it. Well, let me just mention a couple of things before we look at the paper you have. I think it was helpful to me to have George Fouché share a few things with me about what his experience has been in the credit and collection business. And let me tell you a formula that he gave that I thought was helpful. It'll tell you the red light's flashing if the red light isn't flashing already in your mind. One thing that George said was that your short-term debt, that is a credit card, auto loan, this kind of thing, if short-term, that is not a home loan, but a short-term loan, George says, should not exceed 10% of your monthly take-home times 18. Now, let's use an illustration. That'll make it easier for you to remember. Let's just say, to make it easy, that you make $1,000 a month and you take home $800. So 10% of $800 is $80. So what's... excuse me. What is 18 times 80? How much? 1440. Yeah, that's right. I knew I had that answer written down someplace. Okay, he's saying that your short-term debt should not exceed that figure. And then he says a serious problem exists if the short-term debt exceeds 20% of the take-home pay times 18. So really what we're doing there is just doubling that. Now, I didn't say your short-term debt shouldn't exceed 2880. It's 10% of your net, of your take-home, times 18. Don't tell me where he gets the 18. I don't know. But in the credit and collection business, he said, you got a serious problem if you're making $12,000 bringing home $800 a month, if you're making $1,000 a month bringing home $800 a month, and your short-term debt exceeds that, you've got problems. That's what he's saying. How he came up with his formula, I'm not sure, but he's been in that business a long time and has helped a lot of people, and so I just passed that along to you. It's kind of a danger signal. Another thing that George has said, and I've heard many people say this, is that your home and your utilities should not exceed 30% of your gross. So when you add up the home payment, in the sense of those of you in an apartment, or your share of an apartment expense, plus your share of utilities, or in a home, your utility expense, it shouldn't exceed 30% of your gross income. There are other formulas like that that I think are interesting, and George gives some of those in his book. Also, there's another writer. I don't remember the name of his book, and his material is heavy, but you might enjoy it. It's Burkett, who is on the Campus Crusade staff, and he's written some things that take a little more labor to get through, but... And, you know, some of these things are very subjective. Fouché writes from one angle. Burkett writes from another. Bowman from another. It's, you know, finances are really very subjective thing because it deals with a person's way of life that they're raised and their standard of living, this sort of thing. Any questions so far? Because I want to look at this handout that I gave you. Yes.
Where do taxes come in?
Well, what he did here, see, is he took the taxes out. He said, you earn $1,000, you're actually bringing $800 in.
No, but I mean in
the 80. Oh, in this? Taxes? Oh, I'm sorry. In the 80. Yeah, Bowman does mess with taxes, and he may approach it a little different way. You could do it either way, but it's safe for me to say that you could have those three categories and that the taxes would be in the 80. Yes. Oh, we haven't handed them out yet, have we? Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot all about that. They're going to hand out, and when I only brought 100 over, I was thinking there were more couples. And so if each couple would take just one, and maybe some of you singles would share a handout, we'd appreciate that. I can send you another one. There's a pad of paper up on top there and a pen. And if you didn't get one or you'd like anything that I brought over this morning and you didn't get it, just put your name and address down, but be sure and tell me the item you want so that I can mail it to you. I'm sorry, I forgot that we hadn't handed that out. Somebody else was going to say something.
So is that short-term, is that consist of your car, too, your car payment?
Theoretically. You know, that's a tough one to get ahead of when you're a young couple. Because theoretically, you know, we should be saving for the car so that we're paying cash or almost all cash for the car. And I know that's hard to do. And the only way around that that I know of, and let me encourage you about this a little bit, it's not just a hobby. I feel very strongly that there are a lot of good older cars on the market that could meet your need on an almost cash basis without your having to buy a new one. For instance, we have four drivers in our family, and one of our other cars that I really like very, very much, and I don't mind driving up to see some wealthy person in my 1967 Mustang. Doesn't bother me a bit. As long as the car is respectable and clean and this kind of thing. I think I paid $1,700 for that car. It has a six-cylinder engine. It gets excellent mileage. Happens to have a little air conditioning unit in it. And, you know, I could drive that from now to La Rapture. I don't have a problem with that at all. And that's really inexpensive transportation from the standpoint of running the car. Well, you say you get a used car and you got to overhaul the engine. Well, that's a lot cheaper than an enormous car payment, and even though engine overhauls can be very expensive, you can have the equivalent, if you take care of the engine, you can have the equivalent of something that can last you for many, many, more than 100,000 miles easily, maybe 200,000. So I think it's something well worthwhile looking into. We better get on with this control. Would you read what's labeled number one there? If you'd read that to yourselves, and then we'll go from there. Okay, now you'll see what we've really shot for there is to get some idea on how, it's really a guessing game at first to draw up some kind of a budget. By there I used that word. Sorry about that. No, we have to use it sometimes, but I think it scares people, and that's why I hesitate to use it. But I said in paragraph two, as a result of what you've learned, you now have a basis for which to draw up another budget. You have some starting point, and that's really what we're talking about. And so the first thing that I did here, I just used an example budget here that was easy, I thought easy to work with. And I said, okay, here in this given situation are the fixed expenses. Giving, housing, utilities, auto operational, food, life insurance, auto insurance, and license. Those are pretty solid, and we know what they are. They might be the starting point, you say. And by the way, categories that you use, like for instance, I personally put in the utilities, the city utilities, the telephone, the paper, the water, you put into a category that's descriptive for you, anything you want to put in. And I should say this, too. You may not find this useful for you. I find that most people do. But it may just give you some ideas. All I want to do this morning is show you one system to control your expenses, and if that's helpful or gives you ideas, you can adapt it to your own situation. Any way that you can control the resources God has given you, that's what we're really after. Okay, so we see the total unchangeable in this illustration was $9,000. If you turn the page, you see that we had projected spendable income of $13,300, less the fixed expenses of $9,000, so it meant we've unassigned $4,300 in income. So we took the other categories, which are quite flexible usually, and just assigned figures to there. For instance, in personal care and clothing, we talk about haircuts, if you need as many as I do. And recreation, which is a very intangible thing. It's like whether you take a tent to go camping or you're like the man I met when we were up in Wyoming a few weeks ago and he was renting a motorhome for $500 a week. You know, whichever route you go, you've got to put it in here. Household and yard, allowances and gifts and so on, you see those things listed. So we have a tentative total here of $3,360, and then we take the rest of it and add, and we'll talk about this a little bit, the investment fund and the emergency fund. So we've totally allocated the use of those funds into a budget of $13,300. Now, you'll notice what I did is made a list of those items then, and I'll explain in a little bit by an illustration what we mean by the savings fund here in that list under item 4. And you see some things by an asterisk, fixed items. Those are the fixed items we talked about. And then you see the annual expense. It does add up to the $13,300 we anticipate in income. Then the monthly is $1,116. And by pay period, and I am, by the way, dealing with a completely after-tax salary situation here. I just think how somehow it's easier to work with. I just forget the taxes. What do you bring home? And work from there. And so the pay period is $558 in this situation. I do address myself in this paper, which, by the way, in case you do fall asleep, it is a completely self-explanatory paper, so you can read it later. I know it's been a long week, and it's a little too warm in here right now, but you know, if something happens, you will be able to read the paper, so don't feel bad. And see, on top of page 3, I address myself to the fixed salary idea. What do you do with a person who's not on a fixed salary, who gets a commission kind of an income? And so we talk about that a little bit. In item 5, we talk about developing a prayer list, which we already addressed ourselves to in a way. Now what I'd like to have you do is actually go to this illustration in the back, this very full sheet here. And we'll look at what we did in this example. This is what I call a control record-keeping situation. Now just, you know what this really is? This is really nothing but a bunch of cookie jars. I call it the cookie jar approach to controlling your money. Or the envelope system. And I was talking, we had a 13-week session at our church in finances, and another professor of economics out at the academy and myself, we ran the class, and I said, you know, this is just really just the envelope system. The old thing we used to do, I was raised on a ranch in Montana, and you know, you had so many envelopes in the kitchen, you brought the money home and you sold the grain, or ran a few, when we drove some cattle down to the shipping point at the railroad, and you brought the money back and put it in the envelopes. And when there wasn't any money in the envelopes, you just didn't use the money for that. And so that's really what we're talking about here, is it's just 12 cookie jars or envelopes. Jerry White, who's our regional director here in the Rocky Mountain area, said to me, my mother and dad still use that system. Everything goes in an envelope. And if that works best for you, that's the system to use. Now, in this example, what I did here was I said the balance forward in the checking is $385. I pulled that out of the wild blue yonder. There's no reason for it. It just happens to be $385 in the checking account when we started this. Don't think about that column IO for a little bit. I'll talk about that. Giving, I said, okay, where's that $385 belong? What I really did was distribute it to the cookie jars. 20 in the giving cookie jar, 100 in the housing, 30 in utilities, 25 in medical dental, and you'll see my abbreviations when you look back. So all those little columns to the right, starting with giving, housing, etc., equal the amount of money to the left. So there's a double line. My checkbook says I have $385 in it. And what do we do when I look in the checkbook and I have $385? I say, Patty, let's have dinner out tonight. No, what I've really got to do is look to see what I've got in the cookie jar. I've got to look on this little control sheet and say, well, there's $40 in the recreational account, but you know how we live it up, that won't be enough. No, it wouldn't. I'm just joking. And so everything to the right, all these columns then equal that $385. I haven't said anything about any debits and credits, and I'm not. See, a lot of people that are non-accountants just hate this kind of thing, you know, so... Everybody follow me so far? Okay. All right, the next thing I did was get paid, praise the Lord. So we deposited $558 in the checking account and came up with a new total of, $943. We should be so rich. And then we allotted it according to the budget we'd drawn up. We put $55 in the giving account, $100 in the housing, because pretty quick now the housing payment has to be made for $200. 30 in the utilities, and that's a laugh, isn't it, in Ohio? I've been back there. I was in Cleveland last winter, and I know you can't pay a utility bill with that. And medical and dental, 15, care, clothing, etc. And then you see I put that last column off to the right. I'll explain that in just a moment. We put $130 in the savings account. Now, back in that formula that Bowman gave, that 10-10-80, the savings account that I'm really talking about is really mostly this kind of operational thing, and I'll show you what I mean. So anyway, that's what we did. I put 130 over there, and so I added up those things, and it shows a new total of what we have in all those separate envelopes or cookie jars. And so we've got $943 in the checking account now, and this is where the money belongs. Everybody with me so far, except the savings fund. Don't be afraid to ask a question, because I don't want to lose you or go too fast, and I'm guilty of that sometimes. Okay, now, the next thing I did was I called the bank. I may call the bank, or I may have a standing order at my bank, and I do both, to be honest with you. You can have teletransfer service where we call Exchange National Bank here in town and say, will you transfer so much out of my checking to my savings, or will you transfer so much out of my savings to my checking? They asked me the last four digits on my Social Security number, and say, yes, it'll be taken care of today, and that's all there is to it. And I'm sure some of your banks in Ohio are perhaps been doing that for a long time. The other thing is I have a standing order with them to take out so much money per on the 15th of every month and automatically transfer it to that same savings account. So you could do it either way. Now, why did I do this? In this instance, I just called them up and I said, transfer 130. So I took 130 out of that checking account balance and took it out of that savings fund that shows on this description of my checking account. And suddenly on the next page, you see that's where it is. What I've done over here on the next page is showed just a little control diagram of what's in the savings passbook. So over here, I have a savings passbook, and again, I pulled it completely out of the blue sky. $515 exists in that passbook when I started this system. And these are some of the things that I'm saving for that I know are going to happen, but I don't know when they're going to happen, or sometimes I know when they're going to happen, like the auto insurance is going to happen every 6 months or every 12 months. So I'm saying that in the savings passbook already, $100 belongs to auto repair because I know the old 67 Mustang will need something. And then the appliance repair and replacement is $25. I know the refrigerator or washer or dryer or something may need to be repaired, and I don't know anything about Freon. And then auto insurance and license, life insurance comes up, emergencies, and two investment. Now that's that $200 that says two IMV is this 10 that Bowman's talking about here that you're kind of saving for the long-range future. Saving never to spend, as one Savings and Loan Association president here in the Rocky Mountain area describes it. It is saving never to spend, and that's where that $200 is hopefully going. Never to spend till you're retired, that is. Okay, so now you see my 130 got dropped in there. So now my savings passbook says I have $645, and you see where that belongs. It belongs to auto repair and replacement, 40, et cetera, and then you see the totals. That 645 is the total. At auto repair now is 140. Appliance has 50, and so on. Everybody with me so far? Now let's talk about some of the ways for a minute. Well, let me show you a couple of other transactions here, and then let's talk about some of the problems you may have with this or that I have with it, so I can tell you what will happen. Now the next thing is I write a check. By the way, I sit down and kind of do my bookkeeping once a week. Yeah, and it doesn't take very long to do that. Really, it shouldn't be too laborious. But I wrote a check for 130. You saw that. Patty went to Safeway and she wrote a check for 43, and we deducted it from what we had in the food account, so that now there's only 145 left in the food account because she spent 43. Any resemblance to actual figures is strictly incidental. Family of five, including three teenagers. The city of Colorado Springs, we wrote a check for 25, and even in Colorado, that's not true anymore. And we deducted it from the utilities. And then somewhere along the line, a week later or whatever, I drew my totals again. My checkbook said I have $745, and I have the following amounts of money to equal that $745. Now, before I open it to questions, let me explain that IO thing a minute. I won't even tell you what the accountants call it because you wouldn't want to know. You might remember a college course you took in accounting and it would psych you out and you'd never be able to do this. But if you use a credit card, I would say that if you don't use credit cards very often, which is probably better, if you don't use them very often, then I really wouldn't worry about what I'm about to tell you. But if you do use them, enough that it gets you in trouble occasionally, and you need to have some kind of a control mechanism on them. So I've gone to Texaco there. You see, that's what's happened. And I came home with a credit card slip in my hand. So that when I sit down and do my accounting work here, I've got to not only look at what I wrote out of the checkbook, but I've got to take into consideration what I obligated myself to pay somewhere down the line. So what I really did on that Saturday evening or Saturday afternoon or whatever that I sat down and wrote out this stuff and got my stuff up to date, I picked up all my credit slips, and they only amounted to $8. And I wrote down here in my IO column, I owe $8. I put plus eight. I owe $8. And I committed myself in my auto to $8, so I had deducted it over there so that I could tell myself, hey, the red flag is up now. You don't have as much as you think you do because the bill hasn't come in. So you see what I did there? I just said I owe 8, and I minus 8. I took it out of the auto operational in order to keep all my columns balanced. That's why I put in that IO column. Okay, now you'll notice that on March 5th, I did the same thing again. I went to Texaco and I increased my debt by $7 and I reduced my auto operational money that I have available by 7 because I obligated myself to some money. Let's finish this thing. Maybe it'd be better, simpler to do that. Then I wrote my check to the church, minus 50, and took it out of giving. I went down to Rick's Hardware and bought some fertilizer for $14 and took it out of the household and yard. Went to Dr. Johnson and paid cash, minus 15. This is an important thing, too. What do you do with a check you cash? Well, I deducted it, first of all. I wrote a check to the Navigators for cash rather than a gift. We do that around here occasionally. And so somebody gave me $25 in cash. Well, I wasn't sure how we were going to use that. So Patty may have made a comment to me, by the way, would you get some cash because? Or I'm thinking I better get some cash because. So all I do is sort of to the best of my ability, assign that. And I don't worry about the nickels, dimes, and things in my pocket so much. I just write in the checkbook that about 15, I know she's going to need to go down to JCPenney, and 10 is allowance and gifts, so I know there's something coming up like a wedding or something like that. So I just kind of approximate it to the best of my ability. Then I retotaled everything, and everything to the right equals what I have in the checkbook, 641. Then look what we did. Texaco sent us a bill. Prompt as they are, they sent a bill immediately. And so a week after I made my charges, in came the bill. And what I did is I had to take it out of my checkbook, so I wrote them a check for 15 and then reduced my debt by 15. Oh, you know what? I forgot to talk about the Village Inn there, too. But did you see, I indebted myself down there. I went to the Village Inn and spent $25 and took it out of the recreational and charged it on a master charge, and I forgot to mention that. So they were prompt, too, and they sent their bill right away. And so I deducted it and wrote them a check and then took it out of the IO. And so, again, I wiped out my debt there that I had. And again, I'm saying I wouldn't worry about even including this kind of a function in any kind of a control system you have unless you think you jeopardize yourself with too much charging. Then the house payment was due, $100 and $200. And then, look here, I had a valve job or something, cheap valve job for $130. And so I wrote Joe's Garage $130, and I took it out of my savings column over there. And then mutual life insurance, it's only due once a year, and because I'm so healthy, it was only $60. So I took that out and paid that. And then I brought over $190 to pay it, and that kept everything kind of balanced. See what I did? I went over to my savings account and took $190 out of the savings passbook. And I also took $130 out of auto and $60 out of life insurance. And so my savings only had $455, but I still controlled it. I kept track of it. And then I added the $190 to my, because I called the bank and said, add $190 to my checking account, I just added that $190 to cover those bills that I'd been saving for. Okay, questions? Yes?
How do you handle a situation where you need a lot of cash on a constant basis?
You need a lot of cash on a constant basis?
Instead of writing a lot of checks, it's easier to...
Oh, okay. Oh, but yeah, I think that... Let me answer that, because that points up one of the most important features that I learned. I'm always learning from somebody that I'm supposed to be helping. And there was a couple here in Colorado Springs, faculty member at one of the schools here, that I was working with, and I realized that they were on this cash thing a lot. And so one of the things that they suggested to me that they might try is to go to the partial envelope system here. And so what we decided on for them was that each payday, let's look back at our example, each payday starting with the care and clothing column, notice that in this example, care and clothing was 20, auto operational was 30, recreational was 20, food was 138, household and yard 10, allowance and gifts 10. Those six columns, whatever they add up to, $150, $180, $200, $228, something like that, he wrote a check and cashed $228 and gave his wife the $228 and she put it in those six envelopes. And then they operated on a cash basis in those areas. Those were some of the areas where they used to get in trouble before they threw the credit cards away. So they operated on a cash basis on those. Now that, I don't know if that answers, because I'm not positive all you mean by that question, but does that get close to what you're saying?
Well, I just have a very hard time writing down what I spent my cash for.
Yeah.
And is you know, there's...
I don't do that. I just never do it. So if I cash a check, I try and I write in my checkbook, you know, what I used it for. I mean, what I anticipate using it for. And I just don't worry about nickels, dimes, or even dollars. I'm interested in what, in a $5 or $10 category. But I don't take my success diary and write down, you know, when I spend it on a telephone or a parking meter or something. I don't worry about that. Now, some people do. And if you're so... If this is something that you feel you want to be very meticulous about, see, it may just be the way you're wired, and you want to do that. That's, I don't have a problem with that, but I can't. Excuse me, John.
I was going to say, we personally adopted that partial envelope system, and that way you don't have to keep records.
Yeah.
Because you just, and if you have a miscellaneous envelope for parking meters and
yeah.
things like that, you know, it'll be interesting, but... That way you don't have to worry about what you spend the nickels and dimes for, because you don't have to
do
that right now.
Yeah. By the way, I think this thing of Bowman's, too, this approach works good with the kids. You know, they just have three envelopes in their, our kid, three envelopes in their room, so they just drop the money in those three envelopes. That kind of an approach, giving, who else had a question?
I had one question, I'm not sure how much it applies to other people. We went up with two different checking accounts, an expense account as well as our family accounts. And... Going out of town, I guess check for cash to cover me when I'm traveling. I get back in town, I have some of that left, and I wind up picking up milk and bread and, at the store.
Yeah.
Any thoughts as to how to keep those accounts separated?
Jerry Duwalt.
Oh, what was that?
Jerry Duwalt.
Jerry Duwalt.
Yeah. Well, you really could have two control mechanisms. I know for some of you, this thing is just unworkable because of the nature of your financial transactions, but you still have to have some kind of a control. The only thing I'd know how to do that is to have, you know, one control sheet that would equal one checkbook and one that would equal the other. And you know, you know what we're really working on here now, again, is that where does the money belong? Where have you committed that money to that is in the balance on your checking account? That's what we're talking about. That's where we're trying to get a handle on that. And that's really what's happening. It's very hard. Now, the same thing happens to me. I seldom ever travel with a check because nobody wants my checks anyway when I leave Colorado Springs. But occasionally I do. Or I'll run off with the next checkbook, you know, out of the box when Patty has the checkbook, and I'll take the other checkbook out of the box, and then I turn it over and keep track of what's happening on the back of it. But then the numbers get all messed up. Yes.
Well, one method that a fellow in our church uses until recently, when we had to carry ID cards at work, he never even carried a billfold. Now, this man he's one of the top financial troubleshooters. Philip Petroleum Company handles millions of dollars. They wouldn't even carry a billfold.
Yeah.
But as his wife handled all the home, and he handles all the company.
By the way, when I did that memo to my wife, I gave that to somebody the other day and said, I couldn't tell my wife a thing. She's going to have to write me a memo. And that's true in some families, isn't it? So whoever has the information, at least you can record in that book. A friend of mine who lives in downtown New York City, works for American Bell, says, oh, John, we get mugged every so often, so I just carry my money in a clip. I don't carry a wallet, just my American Bell identification card and my money clip. And so when you get mugged, you just hand them the money clip and saves, you know, you don't carry too much money. We better quit. Thanks for coming. Coffee break.